Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
You are listening to CFUV Radio 101.9 FM and online at cfuv.uvic.ca. This is Janet Juniper G and Jen Harmer with you today.
To the edge of the world I go, inscribing the epitaph of my soul. I feel it, I feel it. On a journey to the edge of the world we go, inscribing the epitaph of our souls. We feel it, we feel it, we feel it. As the sky rumbles around me, in the people possibility, my attitude affected by the altitude. I smile in the turbulence, unaffected by your petulance. Yes, I confess, we're on a conquest of content in a black and white shakedown century. People, can you feel me as I swing? Only to the pendulum I'm fielding. Questions in the fallout, pray for rain in a season of drought. Earth phone ringing louder than my cell phone.
Can you hear me as I call?
Can you catch me as I fall? See, I seek to grow tall. Not modified, homogenized, hydrogenized. But glorified and crystallized, I'm mesmerized. And your polarized perplexity be vexing me. But it won't get the best of we, cause on the razor's edge of annihilation, we calling out for regeneration. On the edge of extermination, we calling out for regeneration.
To the edge of the world I go, inscribing the epitaph of my soul. I feel it, I feel it, I feel it. On a journey to the edge of the world we go, inscribing the epitaph of our souls. We feel it,
we feel it,
we feel it. Cause I'm skating on this plane, I'm an ice cold privilege and I'm rigid. The system got me frigid, but money no make joke when them say guiltiness. Rest on them conscience, I confess. My life is excess at the blatant expense of my sisters and brothers. Living in the gutters of our waste, this is embracing haste. A living disgrace to humanity. Accepted insanity propelled by the economic trap. Hierarchy maintaining the gap we call poverty. The rapists of our right we call liberty. The elite not free, addicted materially. Distracted merely from the inequality we see. The people are preserved, the leaders must be served with a taste of the misery. That is reality, for the majority we want justice.
That is constantly prosecuting with bars of insanity, leaving no room to plead for the moneyless of humanity. And so the walls closing by the Babylon system. Yeah, Babylon is a state of mind, is a state of mind. A death row, oh, 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 oh. Who are we to judge? You must go. Death row, oh, 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 oh. Politicians playing as if they know. With their guns and ammunition while they fight for recognition, while the people are left to live on another superstition. Say we're hoping for a new tomorrow, oh, oh. For time to heal our sorrow. We want justice, yeah. We want justice, yeah. We want justice.
And a July 31st midsummer greetings to listeners of CFUV Radio 101.9 FM and online at cfuv.uvic.ca. This is the Women on Air program with Jana Juniper G and Jen Harmer with you here today, broadcasting from the Lekwungen territories of Western Canada. Feminism and the politics of globalization is our topic for today's interview, along with an update or two. So stay tuned as we continue with Women on Air for this hour today. So one of the updates I want to bring up is that this Saturday, August 2nd at noon at the BC Legislature. Protest the Gaza massacre and end Israeli occupation. Bring your flags and your bells and your voices to downtown the Victoria Legislature buildings this Saturday, August 2nd at noon. So, yeah, and remember, we got to stop the killing happening, you know. It's not us here that are doing it, but in some ways we are part of the West that is not saying too much about it. I think the people need to stand up and make your voices heard. For more information, check out the website, bdsmovement.net. That's all one word, bdsmovement.net. And also check out the website, CAIA Victoria. That's caivictoria.ca for more info. And so we're going to get right into the interview for today. And again, this interview is called Feminism and the Politics of Globalization. Today, we will be hearing from Cynthia Enloe, a feminist writer, lecturer, and researcher who has written 14 books on national and international women's issues and has lectured around the world. She has received many awards for her work, along with honorary doctorates from the University of London, Connecticut College, and the University of Lund in Sweden. This is Jana Juniper G. with Cynthia Enloe, speaking on her work and the many ways to build on and continue nurturing a transnational feminist movement.
I'm a university professor at Clark University here in Massachusetts, and my writing and teaching is particularly about transnational feminism, about women in globalized factories, and women's experiences of militarism. Those are the three general areas that I try to keep track of and scribble about. The newest book is called Seriously, with an exclamation mark, and the subtitle is Investigating Crashes, as in banking crashes, Investigating Crashes and Crises as If Women Mattered, and it just came out this past year. When you learn things, you just want to share it, so writing books is just a way of sharing things that you learn and you want other people to know.
How would you define feminism?
Of course, there are many ways to define feminism, but I think one of the hallmarks of trying to be a feminist is taking women seriously. That is, to actually see women's experiences and women's ideas as worth paying close attention to. And that doesn't mean that you think all women or girls are heroes, or all women or girls are necessarily oppressed, or all women or girls are angels. It means that to be a feminist, for me, means paying close attention to women and girls will make you smarter about the world, about injustices in the world, but also about how those injustices can be resisted. So that's one of the hallmarks for me of being a feminist, is to really take seriously women's lives without imagining that all women are the same, certainly, or that all women have the same lack of privilege or the same kind of opportunities, but to take them seriously as a way of making sense of how the world works. The other thing about being a feminist, I think, is being interested in and intolerant of differences in power, unequal power, and unequal rights. To be a feminist does mean, then, that you are political in the broadest, deepest sense of being political, but you're political for the sake of understanding injustice and trying to achieve justice. And justice is something that's very, very difficult to understand. And so to be a feminist means you keep thinking about it, and you think about the ways in which you yourself are complicit, perhaps, in some kinds of injustice. And nobody's born a feminist. You have to learn how to be one. Mm-hmm. And you never are fully one. You're always, every day, trying to be a feminist. You have to constantly remind yourself you have to be curious about things you thought you didn't have to be curious about.
And how does globalization affect women around the world?
Globalization isn't something that is just brand new in the 21st century. When you think about it, globalization is the spread of ideas, sometimes between equals, that is, people who are equals and they begin to share and exchange ideas or practices or understandings, and sometimes it's the sharing of ideas or the exchange of ideas or the spreading of ideas between unequals. For instance, Christian missionaries, Protestant as well as Catholic, were engaging in globalization 150 years ago, more, when they started to try and persuade people who were not Christian to adopt some version of Christianity. That was globalization. And the first, I learned this from a student of mine, the first factory in the Philippines that was owned by an American garment maker to make underwear in the Philippines was started in 1915, not 2015, 1915. And when you think about the history of tennis balls, which are made of rubber, and the rubber for those tennis balls was from the first Dunlop rubber plantations in Malaysia, then called Malaya, in the 1920s and 30s. So globalization isn't brand new. What's perhaps new is how porous all borders are now. And because of the internet, because of shipping, because of airlines, because of the spread of print media, ideas travel much faster and much more widely than they even did at the start of the rubber plantations in Malaysia or the work of missionaries when they went to places like Uganda or Western Samoa over 100 years ago, 150, 200 years ago. For women, if you pay attention to the various ways in which globalization works, one of the first things it does is it makes clear how different women's lives are, including in the United States, so that if you work, or any of your listeners, work for a big Murdoch media company as an executive, maybe in Toronto or in San Francisco or in New York, or in London, or in Melbourne in Australia, your relationship to Murdoch launching Sky TV, which has then soap operas and news programs that now can be seen all around the world and have portrayals of women, your relationship to Murdoch's globalization of images of women is really different than the woman in India, but also the woman in Nunavut, who is the object of those images. So globalization really throws a bright light on how different all of our relationships are to globalization. And it's not just the West versus everyone else. This thing called the West is so diverse that a woman who is working in a shoe factory in North Carolina in the United States, and that shoe factory moves to Indonesia, is going to be really affected by losing her job, and she's going to have to work really hard not to blame an Indonesian woman for, quote-unquote, stealing her job. That's all in quotes. Whereas the woman who loves Converse low-top sneakers in all their many colors, who thinks, oh, wow, I can afford Converse low-tops this year where I couldn't afford them 5 years ago, and doesn't think about, well, I can afford them because Indonesian women are being paid less than women working, black and white women, working in North Carolina in a Converse factory. That woman who's buying the sneakers has a really different relationship to globalization than the woman who just lost her job, even though both of them may live in neighboring towns or the same town in North Carolina. And that's true also in Indonesia. Indonesian women aren't just homogeneous, and their relationship to globalization isn't just the same. There are highly educated Indonesian women, and some of them are, of course, very, just like women everywhere, are very ambitious, and they're going to university, and they're getting engineering degrees, or they're getting marketing degrees, and they will have new opportunities to work for a global corporation that sets up a branch executive office in Jakarta that they wouldn't have had, and they may or may not be at all conscious of how the woman working in the Nike factory in Indonesia, and Nike is a huge employer of Indonesian women, and that woman who's just graduated from university in Jakarta may not give much thought at all as to whether her job in the marketing department of Nike's branch office in Jakarta has any disadvantages for the woman who has come from a rural village and is working in the factory. One of the warnings I think that many feminists around the world are giving us these days is don't lump all quote-unquote Western women together, since Western women differ by their position in the racial hierarchies that are created unfairly, in the class economic hierarchies. But also we shouldn't lump together all women from even Indonesia or from Mexico or from Japan. Women are really diverse within countries as well, and globalization will have an impact on their lives that's really diverse. It means we have to be much more subtle and much more curious and much more energetic when we now think of which women in which countries at which moment are being disadvantaged because their farm products don't sell anymore or because they are working in unsafe factories, and which women are gaining new opportunities and not necessarily conscious of what those new globalized job opportunities are doing to women that they live just across the town from.
Free trade zones are a part of globalizing women's work. Tell us more about free trade zones and their effect on the working conditions and wages of women's work.
Free trade zones are very particular, and that's not the only place factories are. So, for instance, if you look at all the factories, literally hundreds of thousands of factories now that are producing for export in China, not all of them, in fact, most of them aren't in free trade zones. But if you look at Sri Lanka or you look at Guatemala, then, in fact, you'll find free trade zones. So free trade zones are very particular. They're usually, you know, very territorial. They're usually near a shipping port to lower the cost of export. And they usually are created by the local government. So, for instance, Nike doesn't create free trade zones. The government of Indonesia or the government of Sri Lanka or the government of the Philippines creates the free trade zone as a way. Now, so those are local officials, either civil servants and or locally elected, and they create these free trade zones as a way to lure highly competitive international corporations, Japanese, Korean, Canadian, U.S., British, French, Italian, to lure those nomadic corporations to come to their country. And so the free trade zone, you're right, is deliberately set up to lower the cost and raise the profit for that foreign corporation. And part of lowering the cost, so this is a local government crafting this as their strategy to compete for international corporate capital. And one of their strategies is a highly gendered strategy of low-paid women's work to the foreign corporation. And that combined, as you said, with the free trade zone, usually, almost entirely, is without the right to unionize. That's one of the promises, that in your free trade zone, dear corporate executive, you will not have to worry, in quotes, about labor unions. So free trade zones are definitely worth paying attention to, but we shouldn't imagine that every woman who's working in an export factory around the world, in Nicaragua and Guatemala, in China, in Indonesia, in Vietnam, we shouldn't imagine that every woman working for a foreign corporation is working in a free trade zone. But that free trade zone model is a model that does hold out that kind of local government promise to the corporation, we can maximize your profits better than the country right next door. Mm-hmm. So that's countries, for instance, in East Asia and Southeast Asia competing with each other, government officials competing with each other, which is one of the reasons why, to understand I mean, this is what feminists are telling us, and these are Indonesian feminists, for instance, are saying, yes, it's important to keep your eye on the Nike executives in Beaverton, Oregon, just to the south of you, where the international headquarters of Nike is. Yes, it's important to watch those Nike executives and to watch which stereotypes and images of women they wield to maximize their profits. Absolutely right. Keep your eye on the executives, men and women, but especially men, in Beaverton, Oregon, to understand how sexism is being globalized. But the Indonesian feminists say to us, don't think you don't have to watch our own Indonesian male elite, because they are also in the ministries of the Treasury, in the ministries of finance and trade, in the ministries of labor. They are also colluding in the use of stereotypes about women's labor being made cheap to attract that international capital.
Who can we turn to for more information about free trade zones and the globalization of women's work?
The women in the countries where international capital and international export corporations have made the biggest interventions, they are the ones who really are teaching us how to be smart. So Chinese feminists, Hong Kong feminists, Indonesian feminists, Filipino feminists, Mexican, Nicaraguan, Colombian feminists, they're the ones really who can teach us how to pay attention both to the gender politics of their own local elites and the gender politics of foreign government elites and corporate decision makers. You have to watch all of them and their interactions with each other, especially when they go out drinking together, which they do. A lot of business is carried on in all-male drinking clubs.
When we look at international efforts to include more women in governments and decision-making bodies like banks and corporate offices, do you see other ways besides quotas and political party lists and constitutional reform that will continue to strengthen the indigenous women's places in these systems of power that have been primarily male-dominated up to now?
Well, I think, first of all, the quotas and the lists, those really are important, and they're not very widely used. So the EU, for instance, just voted down, the EU Commission, European Union Commission in Brussels, just voted down a very strong proposal to use the Norwegian corporate board quota system for women. Just voted it down as an EU standard. So we shouldn't imagine that corporate board gender quotas or party nomination list gender quotas are widely in use. They are being used more than they were, say, 30 years ago, that's for sure. But we shouldn't imagine, oh, that's old hat. People are already using that. It works or it doesn't work or it barely works. Because, in fact, we scarcely know if it works. But you're right in thinking we've got to really have a really diverse, multi-tool toolbox to try and think about how to lessen the masculinization, particularly amongst privileged men. And in society, in different societies, who is a privileged man is going to differ. Because, you know, Sri Lanka is ethnically diverse, and Indonesia is ethnically diverse, and Mexico is ethnically diverse. So we shouldn't imagine it's just white and people of color. That's not how it works in a lot of societies. It's really by ethnicity and region. But we do have to figure out all the tools that we need in the feminist toolbox to try and pry open the doors of these exclusive decision-making bodies. And a lot of that work is being done by women's caucuses within, for instance, political parties. And women's caucuses have really had quite a powerful effect where those women have really been able to operate inside the parties. One of the things that I've learned recently, because I've been looking back a while ago, I spent a lot of time looking at women in the banana industry, and now I've come back to it and looked again. And one of the things I've noticed is that Honduran women in Honduras, who were working in the plantation packing houses of the big banana companies. This is Chiquita, Del Monte, and Dole. Those are the three big worldwide banana companies. And those women who were washing bananas, which meant that they were usually in pools of pesticide-ridden water, very dangerous for your health. But that's what women were hired on banana plantations. They were the washers of the bananas before they were sent down to the docks and put on the big refrigerated ships so that we could have them at our breakfast table. And those women who are way down the, way down the ladder of banana corporation power, they started organizing in the 1990s, first of all, to get their voices heard in the mainly, or almost all, male-led banana worker unions, while they challenged the big banana companies, Dole, Chiquita, Del Monte. They themselves were sexist in the sense that they assumed that only men really could run the banana workers' unions. And in the last 15, 20 years, these Honduran women have really trained themselves. They've had workshops. They practiced public speaking. They learned about the way the whole system of wages worked in their companies. And they have really made inroads into the unions and now hold more union leadership positions. And that, in turn, means that the big banana corporations have had to take women's concerns about family life, about women's health, much more seriously than they ever did before.
Okay, thank you very much. You just heard the first part of Cynthia Enloe speaking to feminism and the politics of globalization, which, mind you, affects all of us here in Western Canada, all the way around to the other parts of the world that you might not think about very often. But yeah, there it is. So I hope you like what she has to say. We're going to get back to Cynthia Enloe in a few more minutes. I wanted to update you that at the start of our program today, you heard the song Justice by Goddess Alchemy Project from their album release called Frequencies of the Motherland. A very inspirational, amazing women DJ collective from Northern California. Highly recommend their music if you like that sort of thing. They have really a lot to say in their beautiful way of saying and singing it. So yeah, check them out. Goddess Alchemy Project, or Project as the case may be. So let's see. You are listening to the Women on Air program for today. Thanks, Jen Harmer, for being here with me today. And this is Jana Juniper G here. And yes, you just heard the first part of our interview with Cynthia Enloe, who is a feminist researcher and writer from the East Coast of the U.S. So let's see, what do we have going on here? We want to, I think it'd be great before we get into the second part of the interview to play a song that I think talks a little bit about the main messages of our interview today, and it's Lillian Allen with a good question, too.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
You
Yes, thank you, Lillian Allen, for your many good words and songs. You just heard Lillian Allen from her Conditions Critical CD that was a Juno Award winner back in last century. And that song was called Why, dub version number 2. So without further ado, we'll get into the second part of the interview. And this continues on with Cynthia Enloe talking about feminism and the globalization of politics of globalization. Sorry about that.
And they have really made inroads into the unions and now hold more union leadership positions. And that, in turn, means that the big banana corporations have had to take women's concerns about family life, about women's health, much more seriously than they ever did before. It's not a total success story, but it is really a remarkable achievement for these women, starting with the Honduran women. Now they've trained women in Costa Rica and women in Colombia and women in the Philippines, all of whom have a lot more influence in the banana workers' unions than they ever did before. And that, in turn, has meant that issues, for instance, such as sexual harassment, which nobody had taken seriously on banana plantations, neither the men who ran the workers' unions nor the men in the front office had ever taken sexual harassment seriously. Now one of the women leaders of the International Banana Workers Union has gotten Chiquita banana executives to sit down at a bargaining table and take seriously sexual harassment of women on the plantation workplaces. And that's a huge breakthrough. And it came from organizing, talking about what should be in the toolkit. The toolkit has to include lots of different kinds of organizing. And what feminists have taught us from the garment industry and from international domestic workers networks, what they've all taught us is that the kind of organizing that is most effective for women's lives, that allows women really to take part and to gain new skills in worker organizing, has to be really different than the kind of organizing that all male unions have used. For instance, one of the first lessons that they taught us all and tried to teach their male allies in the workers' organizations is you can't hold all your meetings after work if that means nighttime meetings, because women are expected to go right from their workplaces home and get their partners, their male partners, dinner on the table and take care of the kids. And if you have only nighttime meetings, it's almost a guarantee that you'll have only male workers at the meetings. The other thing they all have taught us is what is a worker's issue. For a lot of women, a worker's issue includes sexual harassment on the job, not just wages. It also includes questions of which kinds of skills are women allowed to gain so that they can get better wages and promotions. And those sorts of issues were traditionally not taken up by male union organizers who allegedly were representing their interests. So the issues you have to take up for the sake of organizing, but also the ways in which you organize. Do you have childcare at your meetings? Do you take up domestic violence as an issue for women workers? Meaning, if they're out at night, will their male partners accuse them of having sexual liaisons? Women in Mexico City garment workers' factories said you have to take up domestic violence or you'll never get any women to come to a meeting. So there are lots of things we need to have in this feminist political toolbox that you learn by listening to women who try to organize, and what kind of effective organizing is there, and what kind of failures do women have when they try to organize. You learn from failures. We all do. And sometimes it's very painful to look at your failures. And sometimes looking at failures turns out to be just trying to assign blame rather than seeing it as a skill-building exercise.
Or a learning experience, for sure.
Yeah, and it's hard. It's tough.
And it's all about what is and has happened and how people, women especially, are stepping up to the plate and doing what they can where they are.
Absolutely. And it means that what is considered political can look very minor when it starts. That is, women having workshops on a weekend in Honduras to learn how to speak at a public union meeting. That can look not as if it's about to shake up the world, but it has shaken up the world of the international politics of bananas. But it's taken 15 years.
I have to acknowledge the importance of those building blocks. I think that's what we're talking about, building blocks that increases the skills and knowledge of those involved, and then they run with it.
And which kinds of skills are women presumed not to need? And how do you break through that stereotype? Oh, that women don't have any business of speaking at a public meeting. Women who speak out don't look like proper women. They don't look respectable. And so you have to break through the stereotype, not only held by men, but oftentimes held by other women. She must not be a very good wife. Look at her speaking out in public when her husband is there. She'll embarrass him. It's one woman talking about another woman.
You're talking internal and external oppression.
Sure. I mean, patriarchy, you know, the systematic privileging of certain kinds of masculinities, patriarchy wouldn't exist for another 24 hours if a lot of women didn't find something in it that was rewarding. Wanting to be seen as a respectable woman. Wanting to be seen as, always in quotes, beautiful. Wanting to be seen as a good wife. Wanting to be seen as a sacrificing mother. Those are rewards for a lot of women. And it's really hard to take the daring step of giving up those rewards. Even though patriarchy and patriarchal inequalities and inequities can be tracked back for generations, they don't stay the same, and the workings of the media, the workings of consumerist desires, the efforts to create genuine transnational networks, that's all new. So, yes, it's been going on for a long time, but it also keeps changing. You have to keep your eyes wide open.
And here is Cynthia Enloe talking about how feminist activists around the world are responding to the increasing violence against women and girls in their countries.
Well, I think one of the things that First Nation women have been doing in Canada is making visible these years-long patterns of government officials, police officials, court officials, not taking seriously the disappearance of First Nation girls and women. And so that organizing, that insisting that this is an issue, which means you have to show it's a pattern. That's one of the ways that you make something into an issue. You show that it's not just random, that it is a pattern. And once you can show people and embarrass authorities by showing that there's a pattern of neglect, you're much more likely to get a wider pressuring of public officials to take seriously something that they had rather not taken seriously. This is what a handful of three or four Bangladeshi feminists did in the 1980s and 90s when they went hospital to hospital to try and see if there was a pattern of men who were saw themselves as spurned as suitors throwing acid into the face of the young women that they were pursuing. And not until these Bangladeshi feminists, the small group of them, said, look, it doesn't just happen in this village, and then it happens a year later in another village, and then it happens 2 weeks later in this neighborhood of the city. There's a pattern here, and that's why we even now talk about acid-throwing violence. The fact that we here in Vancouver and Boston even use that phrase is because a small group of Bangladeshi feminists thought, you know what, this acid throwing is not just this disturbed young man getting acid and throwing it at the woman who won't be his wife. This is a pattern of violence against women, and it's a pattern of government and health officials not taking it seriously as a form of violence against women. And I think the same thing is true in Mexico. The reason that so many of us now, belatedly, are alarmed at the scores of women, most of them working women, that is women working in paid jobs, the reason that we now know about the large numbers of women who have been abducted and murdered in and around Juarez is because Mexican feminists in and around Juarez began to note the pattern and made the pattern visible and made the local and national Mexican police authorities' neglect of these crimes visible. And in Nigeria, where the Boko Haram, this very extremist group, militiamen, the reason most of us know about this now is because a group of Nigerian women, many of them mothers and aunts and sisters of the schoolgirls that were abducted when they were sleeping in a dormitory waiting to take their exams the next day. Most of us know about this because Nigerian women printed up T-shirts, printed up banners, and went into the main cities of Nigeria where local and national and international press would be. And with their T-shirts and their banners, they created the slogan, hashtag, bring our girls back. And so while now hashtag bring our girls back is now been co-opted and used in many other countries, that is, who are alarmed at this kidnapping, it was local Nigerian women who crafted that slogan, made up the T-shirts, made the banners, figure out where they could stand, write them in English so that the international media would pick them up. And that's the reason we know about this. Otherwise, we wouldn't know about this. Well, this is because of the activism and the strategizing of Nigerian women.
Here's more with Cynthia Enloe, sharing ideas on how feminists are taking action in exposing patterns of violence in their home communities.
Local organizing, tracking patterns, making visible those patterns, and showing who has neglected and paying attention to those patterns of abuses of women. Those are the people that we're all indebted to.
So I'm hearing that it really is important that local women start organizing among themselves around whatever issue is of importance to them at this time.
Absolutely. And the rest of us need to not just adopt hashtag bring back our girls, but need to think, oh, what else could those Nigerian activist women tell us? Rather than just thinking, send in the American or the African Union troops. If we are made aware of patterns of violence against women, for instance, on the border with Mexico, we need to think, oh, so let's not just be horrified. Let's figure out what else could those Mexican feminists tell us? What else is it that we need to learn from them? And I think very often, and all of us are guilty of this, we just get horrified and then we adopt our own analysis, which may not be entirely wrong, but not right enough, not correct enough. And we don't sort of hold on to our indebtedness to the local women activists who really are the ones who we need to listen to be made smarter. In other words, we're guilty of globalization ourselves. We take an issue oftentimes, and we then think we know all the nuances of it because it kind of fits with some things we've already been thinking about or we've been horrified in other settings. And then we stop listening to the Nigerian activist women, or we stop listening to the Mexican activist women, or we stop listening to the First Nation activist women.
It's all about building bridges between women in all parts of the world.
They have to be bridges that run two ways. And for a lot of us, the bridges should run bridges of communication and bridges of understanding. They're bridges that we should listen to the women on the other side of the bridge before we start telling them what they should do. And that's not easy to do because the media, the international media, the most globalized of media, they'll show a photograph of the women standing in Lagos with their banners and their T-shirts with hashtag bring our girls back. But they won't, the international media won't then interview any of those women. They just treat them as if they're a photo op, not as if they are thinkers and strategists and policy advisors. So for all of us, it means that we've got to be much more energetic in finding what sources are available. So there is a journal, one of many journals, called Feminist Africa. Well, the writers and the editors of Feminist Africa might give us a much better sense of what Nigerian activist women have been doing for years that we've just never paid attention to until this mass kidnapping all of a sudden got us thinking about Nigerian girls and Nigerian women. But most of us haven't paid any attention to all the years of activism and thinking and strategizing that Nigerian women are doing. So for the first time, we're interested in Nigerian girls. We get horrified, but we don't think, gosh, is there any way I can listen to, eavesdrop on, overhear, learn from Nigerian women? And that's what we need to do. That's how you build a genuinely transnational feminist movement. But it means admitting that you don't know much and not being satisfied with mainstream notions of who's an expert.
We can learn a lot from women in other parts of the world, eh?
Oh, absolutely. Well, of course, they are oftentimes a lot more smart than we are. And we shouldn't imagine that Nigerian feminists don't have to deal with ethnic divisions. They're intense in Nigeria, ethnic divisions are. Religious differences in Nigeria are intense and highly politicized. Class differences, rural-urban differences amongst women in Nigeria are pronounced. So we shouldn't imagine we listen to Nigerian women as if any Nigerian woman can speak for all Nigerian women. But we can listen to those activists, feminists in Nigeria, and listen to them about how they try to overcome those differences, how they try to build solidarity across rural and urban women, which is one of the hardest things to do. And that's how we can learn, but not lumping women together in a country and think there is such a thing as the Chinese woman. There's no such thing as the Chinese woman or the Nigerian woman any more than all your listeners would ever talk about the Canadian woman.
Well, that's how mainstream media like to portray us.
Yeah, because I think that one of the distinguishing characteristics of a lot of mainstream media is that they deal in gross categories. And to be a feminist means to be really energetic and to be a lot more curious than most of us think we have the time to be on any busy day. So we do talk about Nigerian women. We do talk about First Nations women as if they're all the, you know, can be talked about without any differences. But, of course, that's what makes trying to be a feminist in one's life so exciting. It takes a lot of energy to be a feminist, but it also is very energizing to be a feminist. I have a lot more energy than I did before I became a feminist.
Thanks to Cynthia Enloe, a feminist writer, lecturer, and researcher from the East Coast of North America. And this has been Jana Juniper G on the Women on Air program for today here on CFUV Radio, broadcasting from the Lekwungen and Coast Salish territories of Western Canada. And thanks for listening.
No change without struggle. You're born, you live, and then you die. And in between you dodge your dubious lies.
Okay, that was Lillian Allen again with her Why, dub version number one. And again, thanks goes out to Cynthia Enloe for her important words regarding feminism and the
politics of globalization. Yeah, globalization affects us all. It's a very big topic, not something to shy away from. Anyway, thanks again to Cynthia Enloe. And before we wrap up the show for today, a couple of things. I want to give you a fast, quick rundown on an update on the Harper's War on Women here in Canada. According to Nikki Ashton, who is an NDPer and MP from Manitoba, in her June 16, 2014 website update, here's the quote, "This law, C-570, was written without consultation and against the advice of most violence against women service providers and legal advocates." What they want to do is change the term sexual assault in the criminal code, change it into the term rape. So actually I went off that quote. The term sexual assault is used for good reasons, as it incorporates a broader definition, unquote. And here's more from Nikki Ashton's MP website regarding C-560, quote, C-560 tries to compel judges in family courts to consider the rights of parents over the rights of children in custody hearings. Both C-560 and C-570 were developed without consultation with feminist organizations or women advocates, and if passed, they would pose serious problems for the legal justice system's ability to protect women and children, end quote. MP Nikki Ashton is pushing a motion called M444, which will create a national action plan to address violence against women across this country. According to Ashton's website, these bills and motions will be voted on in the fall parliamentary session in Ottawa. You can sign a petition on her website that supports the motion 444 that would bring a national action plan to address violence against women across this country. Her website is nikiashton.ndp.ca. That's Ashton, if you're going to do the search kind of thing. And when you go to her website, check out the May 3rd and June 16th updates for more info on what I just yaddled at you. It's really important if you're interested in the rights and freedoms of women here in Canada, because as many know, there's a war on women going on here in this country, no thanks to some politicians, but we won't go there. It's just, yes. This has been Jana Juniper G here. Thanks again to Jen Harmer for shadowing with me today here. I really appreciate her help, and I really appreciate Women on Air, Women Collective here at CFUV. It really makes all the difference for all you women who want to be on radio. Check it out. Women on Air Collective is where it's at, because you know what? We need more women's voices on the air. Thank you very much. And have a good one.